They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Federalist Society's Student Division recently concluded its Federalist Papers Book Club, which ran weekly on Tuesday evenings for 10 one-hour sessions. In this session, Dr. John S. Baker Jr. discusses Federalist Numbers 52, 55, 56, and 57, which discuss the House of Representatives. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome, everyone. This is the seventh session of our book club. Again, we have the email here if you want to send in questions or comments. While we do appreciate those that come in and compliment what we're doing, we don't post them unless there's actually a comment or a question to it. And we're going to see from the first comment that I have from a student that a simple short comment can actually open up a very large discussion. So let's turn to our beginning. And what we're doing today, as I indicated last time, we're shifting from the general principles, and now we're going to apply them to each of the three branches. And this will be more detailed in many ways regarding the motivations of human nature. And this is very important because it addresses some of the problems that or questions that you have. And in particular, let's take the first question up here. So from Sarah, she says, it's interesting that when discussing how often the House of Representatives should be elected, term limits are not discussed at all. Well, yes and no. I mean, first of all, there were term limits under the Articles of Confederation. And in one sense, the whole idea of a stated term, that is 2 years, was considered a term limit. Because in England, the members of the parliament could extend their term, so there wasn't a limit. And I remember one time a friend of mine from England came, and he was in this country for a while, and then it all of a sudden dawned on him, hey, politicians cannot change the date of the election. They can't control it that way. So in a sense, we sometimes take for granted what other people don't have in other countries. But there are other questions here related to it, and that is the term limit issue. Is it really addressed? The main argument is throughout, but in particular in essay number 53. The argument against term limits is basically one of experience and competence, but we'll explore that more as we go along. One of the problems, it seems to me, for many Americans today is not only is the Constitution itself complex, which I hope you understand that by now, but when you layer on it the administrative state, it becomes amazingly complex. And people have no idea, unless they've actually spent time in the federal government, as to how it really does work. And that's what you've got to look at. How does it really work? So in terms of the term limit solution, just like the balanced budget amendment, there is so often the tendency to simply respond to a symptom without realizing what's going to follow from that. Instead, the Federalist is always looking at the causes, and the causes are grounded in human nature. And on the one hand, they're looking at motivations that would drive one to do things for the public good. And on the other hand, motivations that would drive them to self-interest. So whenever you look at something today, what you ought to do, if you want to apply the thinking of the Federalists, and that's what I'm trying to get you to do, is to think, what will this do? What are the immediate consequences? And then back up, well, what are the causes that drive that consequence? So for instance, some years ago, I was dealing with the head of a group that wanted to limit congressional pay. And you may know that the 27th Amendment says that your pay can't go up until after it's proposed and then there is an election. And he said that there was a member of Congress that was very supportive against raising congressional pay. And I said, well, let's test this and ask your big supporter how we would feel if we eliminated the pensions. Well, it was reported back to me that he went ballistic. Follow the money, okay? If you really want to get people in Congress who are there and are there for a short time because they can't afford to be there for a long time, get rid of the pensions. Why? Why do we have pensions in private enterprise? Yeah, it's morphed into something else, but the original reason for a pension is to keep a person in the company. So if you don't want them continuing too long, don't give them a pension. A very easy solution, but not one that people who are arguing for term limits are going to want. Why? Because you term limit them out, and I think it's after 6 years, they get their pension. Now, who in private industry gets a pension like that? Okay, and we're going to look at 57. We're going to see, here's the key thing. When is Congress treating itself much better than the American people? And that's the key issue. And so I urge you to think about these things carefully as we're going through into the next slide. Okay, the issue is the qualification of the electors and the elected. And on the one hand, they were dealing with a mess in the sense that every state differed. And put to one side just the question of slavery, which tends to dominate this, but to realize that some of the states had property requirements. So if you weren't a property owner, you couldn't vote. Later, they had, or maybe simultaneously, they had tax requirements that if you weren't paying taxes, you couldn't vote. Now think about it. People who don't pay taxes and they vote on taxes, they're going to vote for taxes because they're not paying for it, right? Makes sense, okay? Women, okay? Women weren't in there either. Now, here's an interesting thing. These reforms came about at the state level first, not at the federal level. That's the beauty of the federal system. You know, oftentimes people who write in a national publication, they look out at all of the differences from state to state, and they say, it's a patchwork, meaning they can't rationalize it, they can't figure it out. That's the whole point. So early on, I think it was 1838, one state gave women the vote in some small elections, and they went on from there. That's what happens. Why? It's competitive federalism. When one state does something that people in another state want, they point to that state, and that's how you get it. That is much easier to accomplish than trying to get it first through Washington. You get it in enough states, and if it is an issue that deserves uniformity, and that's the key, then you get it. The 19th Amendment, women got the vote, period, across the board. They didn't have to depend solely on the states, but without the states, they wouldn't have gotten it. If it had just been one national government, there would have had to be a national movement from the beginning that was successful as opposed to getting small victories going on. So that's the problem with the electors. Moreover, as he says, for Republican government, the definition of suffrage is critical. Why? Well, at that point, the states defined who were and were not citizens. That was the essence of it. And before the Civil War, the reference to the United States was still plural, not singular. And if they had tried to go in, they would have had to deal with the issue of slavery. And yes, many people wanted them to, and it would have been better in many ways had they done it, except for the fact that the Constitution never would have been approved at that point. They got as much as they could. Now, regulation of the Congress would have been improper. Legislative discretion of the states would have been improper for the same reason and the additional reason that would have rendered them dependent on the state governments. This is as to the elected. A lot of the anti-federalists were upset that the members of Congress were going to be paid by Congress. They wanted the states to pay them. That way they would have a stronger chain on them. That was not in the Federalist plan. And a lot of it has to do with the whole scheme of the House, and that the House has minimal requirements that are not to be tampered with. Next slide. Election qualification satisfactory to the states and safe for the federal government. Why is it safe for the federal government? And here's a good point where the way they're thinking, they're always looking to what the motives of the other are. So it will be safe to the United States. Why? Because it is not alterable by the state governments. And it cannot be feared by the people of the states that they will alter this part of their constitutions. Why? Because it will abridge their own rights. It's a check and balance system. They don't call it that, but that's what it is. It is state and federal power checking each other. And that's all the way through. And I've mentioned before, then when someone is elected to federal office, they have to be certified by the state, but they can be challenged in the Congress in each house. And there were a couple of challenges. At least one, I think, went forward in Iowa this time, but there was a question about a possible challenge in New York. It's a checking system. Next slide. Qualifications for the elected must be uniform. A lot of people think that when the Supreme Court decided the case on term limits, which was in 1995, the U.S. term limits versus Thornton, many people agreed with the dissent by Justice Thomas. I happened to meet him, I think, about 3 days after his dissent. It was certainly a powerful dissent. The problem is, at least as the House, it's just wrong. And I hate to say that, but the whole point is that the states were not allowed to add anything to what the Constitution gave as the minimal requirement to get elected, period. Why? Because they knew that there would be political bias of some kind. And that's one thing as to the Senate, but as to the House is divided by states, but the House is based on national population. It is the national arm. And it seems very odd because often we think of the House as more conservative sometimes, not always, than the Senate. But there's this yin and yang thing with the Constitution. Whenever there is a pull in one direction, you pull them back the other way. The House reacts quickly to human passions that sweep through the population. And those passions are often towards a centralizing end. But on the other hand, by keeping their election every 2 years, they can't get too out of sync with their district. They've got to go back to their district and constantly keep in touch with their district. So on the one hand, they're national in terms of their base. On the other hand, their focus has to be very local. And with the Senate, it's going to be the other way around. We'll talk about them in the Senate. So these are the only qualifications you can impose for election. A representative must be 25, 7 years a citizen of the U.S. At time of election, not before the election, the time of election be an inhabitant, not just a resident, but an inhabitant, must be in no office under the United States. This is to enforce separation of powers. That is, that members of the congressional branch cannot be in the executive branch. And by the way, just as a side note, because it was a possibility during the last presidential election, because we had the question of what happens if neither candidate was enough, 270 votes, and it goes into the House, and what if that doesn't work for some reason, there's a tie, even though the Republicans had more states that they controlled. We now know what Liz Cheney might have done. It might have been a deadlock. At that point, supposedly, the Succession in Office Act comes in. But there's a problem with that. Why? It goes to the Speaker of the House. The Speaker of the House cannot be simultaneously a member of the House, the congressional branch, and then be in the executive branch. So she would have had to resign. once she resigned, she wouldn't have been an officer in the United States, so not qualified to ascend to the presidency. So we avoided that particular constitutional issue, but it could have been a real difficult one. Anyway, this part of the federal government is open to merit of every description, whether native or adoptive, whether young or old, and without regard to poverty or wealth or to any particular profession or religious faith. This is much more open than anything the anti-federalists were talking about. And people look at the Federalists and say, oh, they're terribly conservative. No, this is very radical for the time. They're serious about popular government. They're serious about allowing anybody to be elected by their representatives. And if you spend any time in the House, you'll realize that some districts elect, quote, anybody. There's quite a difference in terms of the abilities that you will find in the House of Representatives. Next slide. So biennial elections, safe and necessary. Anyway, this is a rebuttal of this in the next slide or two as to electing every 2 years. Thank God we don't elect every year, which is what the anti-federalists want. Can you imagine? As it is now, members of the House basically fly back to their districts every weekend. They're always in touch with their district, unless, you know, they're at high level. Some of them don't go back. But if you're in California or something, that's a long hike. And that's why you find out that Congress doesn't, and the House doesn't really meet until Tuesday. And then they leave on Thursday. So it's a 3-day week and the rest of it is traveling and back in the district. Next slide. Frequency of election is essential. The branch under consideration should have an immediate dependence on the immediate sympathy with the people. Frequent elections are unquestionably the only policy. Experience, and the reason I've got this one highlighted at the bottom here is that experience is a guide that they're always looking at. Again, while theory has a place, and certainly Madison knew all the theory, even Madison was tweaking the theory constantly based on experience. He did that as to federalism. He did that as to separation of powers. Okay, representation. Modern use shows biennial election not a threat to liberty. This kind of election was relatively new, he says in the first paragraph. And then he goes down and looks at the experience of the colonies under British rule and concludes that it is proof that the liberties of the people can be in no danger from biennial elections. I think most people would agree today, unless they want to themselves simply vote from their own remote control unit. Next slide. Three circumstances reinforce the biennial elections not a threat. A lot of this turns on the limited powers of Congress. And we know that Congress has expanded its powers as a result of the progressive movement. But first, part only of the supreme legislative authority, which is vested completely in the British government. You know, back to Judge Thapar, he kept thinking that the federal government, from the beginning, the plan was to amass all this power. It really wasn't. Why? Because they knew there were only certain things that the federal government could do. It was those things that no state by itself could do. And they wanted experience and they wanted focus on this. And if there were too many issues for them, they couldn't do it well. And if they didn't do their job well, people would not become attached to the union. And that's what they wanted, attachment. The greater the power, the shorter ought to be the duration. And conversely, the smaller the power, the more safely it may be the duration protracted. Given, you know, what we have today, as people often say in Washington, we're now safe whenever Congress is in recess. They can't do any more damage than they're likely to do. So here's another point where the 17th Amendment comes in. after talking about the dependence on the people, says, but that it will be moreover watched and controlled by the several collateral legislatures. That's state legislature. Really, this is an information system, as I've said before. The checking that's supposed to occur in federalism is horizontal. We don't have that today. The third place, no comparison can be made between the means that will be possessed by the more permanent branches of the federal government for seducing, if they should be so disposed to seduce, the House of Representatives from their duty. What might those be? There are various ways, innumerable ways, but it turns out that the House is pretty powerful and they understood the power in the House. And you can see it certainly under Speaker Pelosi. It's a powerful House. Nobody really has any doubt about that. With less power, less sentence, therefore, to abuse the federal representatives can be less tempted on the one side and will be doubly watched on the other. What we have today is there are more power, therefore more temptations for abuse, and the state legislatures aren't watching them because they don't have any incentive. It wouldn't make any difference, except to watch for handouts. Next slide. Okay, 53. This was not in the syllabus. I added it. So let's go to the first slide. The claim, and this is what the anti-federalists were saying. This is a quote, that where annual elections end, tyranny begins. So that was a slogan. And as is remarked by Madison, yeah, there's truth in certain slogans. The problem is it can be taken beyond its logic. And the logic of that slogan had to do with a number of things in England, not in the U.S. And the U.S. situation is very different from that in England. In searching the grounds for the doctrine, I can discover but one, and that is wholly inapplicable to our case. The important distinction so well understood in America between a constitution established by the people and unalterable by the government. That's key. Any law established by a government and alterable by that government. So in England, in Great Britain, it is maintained that the authority of the parliament is transcendent and uncontrollable as well with regard to the constitution as to the ordinary objects of legislative provision. That's why you say, or England says, it has an unwritten constitution. Why the parliament can amend it by adding to the unwritten constitution pieces of legislation. Next slide. Unlike England, the constitution does not allow for changing of elections. I've talked about this already, but they had accordingly in several, this is in England, actually changed by legislative acts some of the most fundamental articles of the government. They have, in particular on several occasions, changed the period of election. Last sentence. Where no constitution paramount to the government either existed or could be obtained, no constitutional security similar to that established in the United States was to be attempted. Look, a lot of countries have so-called constitutions, but if you can ignore it, it's not a real constitution. And in so many countries, they are, I like to say, third world constitutions. Of course, we've got a number of state constitutions that aren't much better. Next slide. The second question, are biennial elections useful? Yes, why? No man can be a competent legislator who does not add to an upright intention and sound judgment a certain degree of knowledge of the subjects on which he is to legislate. I mean, we get people going to Washington who know nothing, okay, except how to campaign. But many of them actually come up through state legislatures. They know a good bit. However, for many of them, when they get to DC, they don't realize that it's not just a bigger state legislature. So for instance, I know from personal experience that is it possible to get through a state legislature, a controversial piece of legislation, the first time it is tried. That doesn't happen in DC. That it just doesn't happen. Unless the media has beaten it down so much ahead of time that it is ramrodded through with some tragic event. Another part can only be attained, or at least thoroughly attained, by actual experience in the station, which requires the use of it. So members of Congress who come from state legislatures, they have a certain background, but they still have a steep curve. Unfortunately, what happens to many of them is that they hire staffers who've been around a long time. On the one hand, this is good in the sense that the staffer, you know, attunes them to what's going on. On the other hand, some staffers I know from past talking to them think that they need to show the new member how he or she is to act, and that they really need to disregard that campaign manager that they brought from their state up here, who really doesn't know how things work up here. There's kind of a built-in elitism that you'll find everywhere. Next slide. And by the way, if you want to term limit anybody, term limit this man. More knowledge required for federal office. Why? You know, in one state, it's one thing to learn the laws of that state. But what are we dealing with? We're dealing with, he says, the great theater of the United States. What was that great theater? 13 states. What's the great theater today? 50 states. How are you going to get this information? The information has got to come from the members and their districts. And that's why it's very important that they do go back and hear from their members and their local chambers of commerce and their local labor unions and all of that. That's critical to the operation. Diversify the local affairs connected with them and can with difficulty be corrected, learned in any other place than in the central councils, to which a knowledge of them will be brought by the representatives of every part of the empire. And he's going to go on about foreign trade, and I've cut out some of the other stuff, but the whole point is there are four areas that Congress was supposed to deal with only. And just to be knowledgeable on those four areas, foreign trade, domestic trade, foreign affairs, and military, that's a big job. But now we've got members of Congress who are dealing with all kinds of other things. So then when it comes to the critical things, they maybe have no experience on it other than dealing with a bill that's been put before them with no time to read it. And they're expected to vote on it, and they have to rely on others. And then he goes on, these are the principal objects of federal legislation. That's what I've been talking about. That's where they need to concentrate, but they don't. Next slide. The future course of federal legislation. Now, if you go back to the first Congress and you look at the bills that they actually drafted, like the Judiciary Act, it's a beautiful piece of legislation. It understood the structure. It's considered, you know, although not equal to the Constitution, it has a very high status. These were competent people who had the experience of the convention, and they drafted a beautiful document. They drafted it, not somebody else, not a lobbyist, not a staffer. And it's short. Today, it's all the opposite. By staffers, by lobbyists, and long. Why? The longer it is, the more complicated it is, and the more difficult it is to understand it, even if you have time to read it. It is true that all these difficulties will, by degrees, be very much diminished. The most laborious task will be the proper inauguration of the government and the primeval formation of the federal code. Now look at the federal code. Now look at it. Have they learned anything from drafting before? If they have, they haven't, you know, shown it very well. The way they draft, I was looking at a bill last night, and unlike state legislation, where typically they cross out the old language if they're amending it, and they put in the new language so you can see what's changed. They don't do that in the federal legislation. They say after this word in the existing legislation, add these words, which means you have to have the existing legislation and this together. You have to merge them somehow. Can you imagine 2,000 page bill and you're given 3 days to read it? You can't possibly do that. So the whole premise is, in each party, you're supposed to vote the way the leadership tells you. Ah, guess what? With term limits, that's even worse. Why? They have less and less knowledge. And with less and less knowledge, those who have been around longer are the ones who are going to dictate how the voting goes. And the increased intercourse among those of different states will contribute not a little to diffuse a mutual knowledge of their affairs, as this again will contribute to a general assimilation of their manners and laws. A general assimilation is what the Federalists are all about. That is, they see the factions out there, yes, they plan for them, but over time, they expect that the differences among different states and regions will be somewhat reduced. On the one hand, you see it very much today where people move from state to state, sometimes not having any attachment to the new or the old state. But if you go into advertising, you will see that advertisers still at least make regional differences. What is acceptable in advertising in New York and on the East Coast may not be acceptable in Texas and the South. So we still have differences, but it's more regional today. And that, again, is largely due to commerce. But with all these abatements, the business of the federal government must continue so far to exceed both in novelty and difficulty the legislative business of a single state to justify the longer period of service assigned to those who are to transact it. I don't think anybody would dispute that today. The problem, as I keep saying, is that that's not what they're doing. They're flying back and forth to their district, fine, but then the rest of the time is spent raising money. Next slide. The relationship of longstanding members to the others, and this is really about term limits. It is the answer. A few of the members, as happens in all such assemblies, will possess superior talents, will by frequent re-elections become members of longstanding. Skipping, the greater the proportion of new members and the less the information of the bulk of the members, the more apt they will be to fall into the snares that may land for them. I think if you look at least at some of the states where they have term limits and you have very little experience in the legislature, it may, depending on the state constitution, make it much more easy for the governor to able to get the legislature to do what it wants. I'm not saying there cannot be problems with people spending too long in either a state or a federal legislature. But again, I say look to other solutions to that. One of the solutions, besides the pension thing, Congress, when it redistricted or reallocated reapportionment, did at least prior to 1921, it had a provision, at least for some years, I don't know how many censuses they did this for, which required that the districts be compact. Well, if you looked at districting over the last 25 years, you know that they're terribly uncompact. And it's not that there can't be political influence even on a compact district. But the whole idea is the district is supposed to conform in some sense to a notion of community. Next slide. Time to deal with those wrongly elected. The point of this slide is that if you're electing people every year, and if somebody is wrongly elected, the time it would take to deal with it, both the evidence, remember, it's both a state and a federal problem. So let's say the loser goes to Congress. Let's say the loser is a member of the majority party in the House. That loser may say, I actually won. This was a fraudulent election. And maybe there is some evidence of that. But if there is evidence, what they're going to have to do is go through a process to determine the evidence. But by the time all this happens, you're up for re-election if what we're talking about is 1 year. And so what he says is, down at the bottom, so a greater portion of the year would be unavoidably elapsed before an illegitimate member could be dispossessed of his seat, that the proposal of such an event would be little check to unfair and illicit means of obtaining a seat. it's a real problem. It is very difficult, as a lot of people discovered this past election, to challenge an election. I was, as I said before, in an election challenge back in 1996, and there just isn't enough time, and deliberately so, in order to reduce the number of election challenges. Next slide. So we're going on to Federalist 55 now. First slide under Federalist 55. Charges against the size of the House. Okay, so he's going to go through a series of things regarding its size. First, the charges that it's too small, and that would be unsafe. Second, it will not possess a proper knowledge of local circumstances of their numerous constituents. Third, that they will be taken from the class of citizens which will least sympathize least with the feelings of the mass of the people. Again, this there's a strong populist element in the anti-federalist critique, and they're viewing the Federalists, because they're lawyers and merchants, as being in an elite or wanting to be in an elite. Fourthly, the increase of people and the obstacles which will prevent a correspondent increase of the representatives. Next slide. Okay, the first charge is the number of representatives should be large enough, but not too large. Now, think about this. How do you get this number? How do you get this number? We'll come back to this, but as we're going through it, think about this. Nothing can be more fallacious than to found our political calculations on an arithmetical principles. 60 or 70 men may be more properly trusted with a given degree of power than 6 or 7. But it doesn't follow that 600 or 700 would proportionally be a better depository. A certain number at least seems to be necessary to secure the benefits of free consultation and discussion, and to guard against too easy combination for improper purposes. And of course, with the Senate, the whole point is to keep the numbers small, relatively small, so there can be deliberation. The House really doesn't deliberate. It votes, it does committees, but there isn't the same kind of deliberation that you at least used to have in the Senate. In order to avoid confusion and intemperance of a multitude in all various numerous assemblies of whatever characteristic component, passion never fails to wrest the scepter from reason. That's the problem. Had every Athenian citizen been a Socrates, every Athenian assembly would still have been a mob. So it can't be too small as to be a cabal, and it can't be too large as to be a mob. That's the problem we're dealing with. Next slide. So he relates to the limited powers of Congress, but I want to mention this, and it may come up in a later slide. In the what we call the Bill of Rights, was not just a Bill of Rights submitted to the states. There were 12 amendments, you may know, submitted to the states. And the first two were procedural. They were not in that same sense. And of course, people who say that the First Amendment is first because it was the first, most important, that's nonsense. The First Amendment was number 3 going out. The second one we have later ratified as the 27th Amendment. That's the one on congressional pay. But the first proposed amendment had to do with the changes in the ratios regarding the size of districts for Congress. So it starts out with 30,000, which is in the text of the Constitution. And then it goes up to 40,000. And then it goes up to 50,000. And had that amendment been adopted, it would have stuck at 50,000. That amendment came close to passing, but it didn't pass. Had it passed, we would need 6,000 members of the House today. Thank God it didn't pass. for some reason, he's relating this to the limited powers of Congress. Again, if it's limited as it was at the beginning, that's one thing. The question, how to deal with it now when it's not. Next slide. So for the foreseeable future, would a low number of representatives be able to pursue tyranny? And he doesn't think so. Of course, you would expect that answer, but he gives reasons. Their present temper or under circumstances which can speedily happen will choose in every second year, repeat the choice of 65 or 100 men who would be disposed to form and pursue a scheme of tyranny or treachery. I mean, it's not realistic back then. Might it be more realistic today? Maybe. But we have a very different situation. Down at the bottom, what changes of circumstances, time, and a fuller population of our country may produce requires a prophetic spirit to declare, which makes no part of my presentation. You know, they often say the founders couldn't foresee things. Well, they foresaw that they couldn't foresee. And this is one of the real problems about the number. There is no magic number here. Next slide. So there cannot be any crossover between the executive and the legislative branches. I've mentioned that before. Again, that is a point he makes in terms of not contributing to the danger that the anti-federalists are worried about. The danger of the other branches, could it mean, where it could come from? Where it could come from would be appointments, except that members of the House or members of the Senate cannot be appointed to the executive branch until they've resigned. As there is a degree of depravity in mankind, as down at the bottom, requires certain degree of circumspection and distrust. So there are other qualities in human nature which provide a certain portion of confidence. Republican government presupposes the existence of qualities in a higher degree than in other forms of government. As we've said, even though the anti-federalists were more focused on virtue, it's not that the Federalists didn't think that you didn't need virtue, but they thought virtue plus competence, whereas the anti-Federalists weren't concerned terribly much about competence, but that their representatives looked and acted just like they did. Next slide. Okay, so Shea is asked, it's interesting that the states varied so much in their proportions of people and representative power. However, the essay does not explain the number 30,000. Well, what happened was on the last day of the convention, September 17th, a motion was made and accepted that the number be reduced from 40,000 per district to 30,000 in order, maximum, in order to allay the fears of the opponents. And just a final thought, it was really interesting to read about the presupposition necessary for self-government. That's one we have to think about today, because people have taken the idea of liberty and freedom to the point that they seem to espouse the idea that there's no obligation to the public good. Certainly neither the Federalists or the Anti-Federalists believe that. The whole thing about republic means self-government, and you've got to govern yourself. And of course, if you're addicted to heroin or some other terrible drug, you're not able, practically speaking, to govern yourself. And if you get a high proportion of society with people who can't take responsibility, you're going to have serious problems in a republic. Next slide. We're on to 56. Okay. The second charge members make, they're too few to know the interests of the constituents. This is an interesting point. The answer is really, I think, very astute. And ignorance of a variety of minute and particular objects, which do not lie within the compass of legislation, is consistent with every attribute necessary to the due performance of legislative trust. They don't have to know everything. What they have to know is what they're there for. And unfortunately, too often, when there's so much that seems to be part of their responsibility, they can't really learn enough about anything. And therefore, don't focus on the things that in the Constitution are critical. What are to be the objects of federal legislation? Those which are of most importance and which most to require local knowledge are commerce, taxation, and the militia. How many members of Congress understand the militia? I mean, I understand a lot, but I don't understand enough about the militia. I'm interested in watching this fence around the Congress. And what does that mean? Who is responsible for calling out the militia? Is the Congress attempting, or at least the Speaker, attempting to have control over a military unit? If that's the case, nothing could be further away from separation of powers than that notion. The idea that a legislative body could have power related to the militia is really a frightening thing. What are to be the objects of the legislation? Again, those which are most important. And what are they? Commerce, taxation, and the militia. Let's get back to basics. Next slide. The likely member background of the members is, you know, he's saying will be state legislative experience. But that's not always true. But thankfully, it is true for a good number of them. Next slide. The complexity of knowing laws of multiple states, 13 and 50, I've already mentioned that, but the information so far as it may relate to local objects is rendered necessary and difficult, not by the difference of laws and local circumstances within a single state, but of those among different states. But you know, when you have ignorance on the part of members and they're not actually looking at the drafts of the legislation, it is very more likely that you will impose a uniformity that is inconsistent with local concerns. But who protects against that? Not the state legislatures anymore. Well, business will be protected because the U.S. Chamber will protect it. And then to some extent, local businesses, but primarily large businesses. And to the extent that they're protecting large businesses, frankly, don't care about states. And they just assume not have to be subject to their laws. I mean, I've heard general counsels for major corporations say this. That's not making it up. So the reality is when many people in this country feel they're unrepresented, there's good reason for that feeling because we've gone so far away from what the wisdom of the federal was built into this. But it's always in the name of power. And that's what it's all about, as I've said from the beginning. Next slide. The growth of complex industry. The point here is that right now, most of the states are in a state where he says a society of husbandry, second line. A few have really made progress in the branches of industry, which give variety and complexity to the affairs of the nation. Again, I said at the beginning, especially in Federalist 11, the Federalists are talking about a commercial republic. It's commercial not only to increase wealth, but to increase factions. The foresight of the convention has accordingly taken care that the progress of population may be accompanied with a proper increase in the representative branch of the government. We just talked about that, and thankfully that we don't have 6,000 representatives. Next slide. Okay, Federalist 57 is really interesting. So let's go to the first slide. The third challenge is members will be from elites. That's what the anti-federalists were arguing then. And today, many people are arguing the same thing. But the situation is different. They will be taken from a class of citizens which will have least sympathy with the mass of the people. Well, that's not necessarily true today. But what happens when they get to Washington? What happens when the party tells them they want them to vote this way, even though the member wants to vote the way that he or she thinks would best represent the constituents? What do they do to that kind of member? Do you think they get advancement in terms of the committees they want and other things? The leadership has all kinds of ways of punishing members that don't want to go on. Now, remember, at the outset, the assumption is that we're going to have members who bring knowledge together and they're going to be in conflict and they're going to write the legislation. But once you start increasing the number of members and the scope of legislation, what happens is the centralization of power. The Speaker in the House and the leader in the Senate, but less so, become more powerful. And of course, if you're Speaker of the House, what do you want? More power, of course. What one of the other ways they get? We've talked about term limits in terms of election, but what about term limits of chairman? So both parties pretty much have three-term limits for when somebody can chair a particular committee. Well, in the old days, the people who went into Congress, especially from places where they were not likely to get defeated, certainly in southern states, they would go in with the notion that they could be there for 30 years. And if they were in a committee over that 30 years, they would learn a lot and other members would turn over. And eventually, he or she today would be chair of that committee. So they had the incentive to learn it. The problem today is that when you limit the chairs, yes, you limit their power, but you enhance the power of the speaker. It's necessarily the case. So that's one thing. But two, when you get a chair that is competent, can you imagine he or she is so competent, more than the members, and now has to go back as a member of that committee? What's their incentive at that point? Their incentive at that point is to leave. Now, back, I think it was in 19, President Trump, then President Trump, wanted the Republicans to change the rules because too many members were leaving, because it wasn't in their interest to stay. You were losing knowledge. This is a problem in all corporations today, the loss of knowledge. Well, it's also a problem in the Congress, the loss of knowledge. Well, that knowledge is not lost. Where does it go? Where do they go? They go to high-paying lobbying jobs. So would you want to go back and be a lower-ranked member of the committee, or you want to go out and triple, quadruple your salary and not have to put up with this stuff? They're not thinking the way the framers did, or at least the Federalists did. That is, what are the human incentives? You got to pay attention to those. Whilst the objection itself is leveled against a pretended oligarchy, the principle of it strikes at the very root of Republican government. But they didn't know at that point that the progressives were coming along. Next slide. Okay. So Raymond has a question. Well, it's a long comment. Federalist 57 addresses the concern that the House of Representatives would eventually become a self-dealing oligarchy. Well, in large part, it has. Down the bottom, the revolving door nature of MCs, members of Congress, and the current structure of party government in the Congress appears to cut against Madison's contention that selfish nature of representation would bind them to their constituents. It wasn't just selfish representation. It was the structure of the Constitution. But when you paper it over and you change things elsewhere in the Federalist, it says, when you get too many laws, you don't have the rule of law. When you get too many laws, you can't know the law. When you get too many laws, you need too many lawyers. Where are you going to get those people who are knowledgeable about the law? You hire them once they come out of the Congress because they wrote the law. That's the way it works. Next slide. The end and the means of it, of obtaining wise, wise rulers and preventing their degeneracy. The aim of every political constitution first to obtain is to first obtain for rulers men who possess most wisdom to discern and most virtue to pursue the common good of the society. It can't all be selfishness. And in the next place, to take the most effectual precautions for keeping them virtuous whilst they continue to hold their public trust. The elective mode of obtaining rulers is the one for republican government. The means for preventing the degeneracy are numerous and various. The most effectual of these limitations are term of appointments. Now, most people think today it's the number of terms, but go to the next slide. Who are the electors and the elected? Because of time, I want to, this repeats what we've done before. So let's go to the next one. So they're supposed to be distinguished both because of their fellow citizens, but there is a motive here somewhat distinguished also by qualities which will entitle to them and which promise a sincere and scrupulous regard to the nature of their engagements. In the second place, they will enter into public service under circumstances which cannot fail to produce a temporary affection, at least for their constituents, to their constituents. Next slide. The selfish motives, he continues here, the motives of a more selfish nature. Notice he's doing several. Public service, binding to constituents, and selfish. What's the selfish? His pride and vanity attach him to a form of government which favors his pretensions and gives him a share in the honors and distinctions. A great proportion of men deriving their advancement from their influence with the people would have a more to hope from a preservation of their favor than from innovations in the government subversive of the authority of the people. Next slide. Fourth, frequent elections. Because of time, I want to run to the next slide. Fifth, this is the one. Fifth, they can make no law which will not have a full operation on themselves, where they've been doing just the opposite. And their friends, as well as on the great mass of society. The whole principle is that members of Congress were to enact laws that they could live with themselves. This has always been deemed one of the most strongest bonds by which human policy can connect the rulers and the people together. It creates between them that community of interest and sympathy of sentiments of which few governments have furnished examples, but without which every government degenerates into a tyranny. Next slide. So the objection is, well, you know, how are you going to make sure of this? I answer it. The genius of the whole system, the nature of just and constitutional laws, and above all, the vigilant and manly spirit which activates the people of America, a spirit which nourishes freedom and in return is nourished by it. If the spirit shall ever be so debased as to tolerate a law not obligatory on the legislature as well as on the people will be prepared to tolerate anything. Well, guess what? Back in 1994, when Newt Gingrich ran, he was saying, we have to make members of Congress subject to the same civil rights laws as everybody else. They made a change, but it didn't subject them to the same law. In 2018, after scandals about payouts for sexual harassment, there was another change. It's still not quite the same. On the Obamacare thing, Congress took care of its own, took care of itself, took care of its staffers. There is a two-tiered system in so many areas, and there are too many to talk about because you have to dig them out. Next slide. This is the best prudence can provide. It is possible that these may be insufficient to control the caprice and wickedness of men, but are they not all the government will admit and the human prudence can devise? We come back to the same thing. If the people are not virtuous enough and not concerned enough, then they will get corruption and tyranny. Next slide. We're out. I thought we had another question, but let me finish with this. The email again, but I want to mention this. In the text of the Constitution, in Article 1, Madison had to deal with the deviousness of members of Congress. And what he was concerned about is that in Article 1, it talks about every bill having to go to the president, presented to the president. And he added what appears to be redundant, but he adds other words, any order, anything that requires a vote of two houses, except certain formalities, has to go to the president. He understood the deviousness, but he didn't completely catch it. The real deviousness here is the size of the bills that effectively gut the ability of the president to veto. People want a line item veto. No, that's not what we need. We need single subject legislation so that they actually have to write separate bills that can be separately vetoed. Again, people come up with a solution that only goes to the symptom. It doesn't go to the cause. But we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article 1 initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/Article I. That's fedsoc.org/Article I.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.